Hello and welcome to this episode of the Global Innovators in Business series. In this series, we bring leaders and innovators from different fields to share their advice and experience with undergraduate students to provide inspiration and motivation during the pandemic. We're so happy to have with us Mr. Atish Davda. Atish is a co-founder and CEO of Equity Zen. He is leading the way for anybody to take part in investing in companies like Allbirds, Robinhood, and SpaceX before they go public. This full interview is dedicated to Penn Pro Bono Alumni Consulting, or PennPAC. PennPAC works with nonprofit organizations to solve their business challenges through the engagement of Penn alumni who serve as pro bono consultants for short-term projects. In short, they're a nonprofit that helps other nonprofits. So thank you so much for coming, Atish.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Christopher.
So the first question is always, why did he choose to dedicate this interview to PennPAC?
Yeah, look, it's a nonprofit that helps other nonprofits, and it's a multiplier for folks who want to do good. Effectively, quick spiel from my end for PennPAC is it provides consulting services like McKinsey, Bain, BCG, et cetera, specifically for nonprofits who otherwise would not be able to afford those services. Mm-hmm. These consulting services are delivered by Penn alumni to nonprofits that need to have no affiliation with Penn whatsoever. And we're always looking for more volunteers and more nonprofits. So if anyone's interested in doing some good or even spreading the word about it, just head on over to pennpac.org and we'd love to have your support.
What has been the most impact value add project that you've worked on in PennPAC?
So I work in PennPAC corporate, or basically on the boring side of things. And it's funny because PennPAC is full of people who have full-time jobs, and no one, even before the pandemic era, no one would say that they had a ton of free time when you have a full-time job. Many of us have families, but one of the most kind of inspiring parts of PennPAC has been watching folks who have usually not 40-hour jobs, usually 40, 50, 60, 80-hour week jobs sometimes, still put in a lot of time to do good and help others do good. There's just so many projects, a lot of them surrounding education that are a little bit near and dear to my heart. And so I've been a little bit of behind the scenes, like multiplier for this organization that tries to be a multiplier for others. And it's been really rewarding.
That sounds amazing. Yes, check out the description below to learn more. And okay, so the first question goes way back into your childhood. What was the first business venture project that you started working on?
So I have to admit, I actually was a little bit slow to be bitten by the entrepreneurship bug. It didn't happen to me until I actually took a class in undergrad. But from a very early age, I had the gift/curse, if you ask my parents, of curiosity. I was always taking stuff apart, putting it back together most of the time. Appliances at home, parts of a car, Legos are one of my favorite toys. Long story short, I had this bug about curiosity, about how things are built. There were a lot of, why is it this way and why not that way type questions. And that is the one, I wouldn't say one memory, but one kind of recurring theme in almost every childhood memory I have is someone answering a question and finally getting fed up with, all right, we just need to get Atish out of here. Otherwise, he's going to keep asking why not.
I see. And going from that, you went to Penn. This background seems like an engineering-focused background. So at Penn, what did he study? And then how did he move your way into finding your job at AQR?
It is an engineering-focused background. I entered Penn as a computer science and engineering major in School of Engineering Applied Sciences. I ended up applying to dual enroll and was fortunate enough to get into Wharton as well. And I ended up focusing on finance there. And I think I had a minor in mathematics at the time. Basically, I love numbers. I'm a big numbers nerd. Anything that can be quantified, especially if there's a way to apply it to real life, I just really enjoy. And so AQR Capital, which is a hedge fund, a quantitative hedge fund, was a really great place where I got the opportunity to continue, frankly, not making a decision about which path I liked more and just have a little bit of both. We had the numbers, we had finance and investing, and we had computer engineering. And so it was at the time one of the growing but not yet largest asset managers out there. Mm-hmm. Four of us good friends, all from undergrad and Penn, decided to continue a version of college life, like a variety of it. So it was just a really good breeding grounds for us to nurture interests. Two of the four of us are still there loving it. And two of us have since left and are down our own paths of starting our own company. So it was just a really good place for ideas to be bred and exchanged.
I think what you're saying is very interesting. So many students need that buffer zone or need that time to still consider. Even me, I just graduated, but I'm still considering what is that next step. And do you think going to AQR or going to a job right after college that is more focused and more quantitative and very hardworking is a good buffer before you figure out what you want to do in the future?
Oh, wow. Okay. Two things to say about that. One is a little bit of a general comment. Look, when you graduate college or when anyone graduates college, at least in the US, you're talking about potentially making a decision about a career where you're going to spend the next 40 to 50 years of your life. It's a big decision. That's a long way of saying it's okay to take another 2, 4, even 5, 10 years before figuring out exactly what you want to spend the rest of your career doing. And there's plenty of people who make changes late in their career as well. So it's never quite off the table. So that's a general answer. The more specific answer for me, at least, is I knew I wanted to do something where numbers were involved, where computers were involved, and where finance, and specifically the applied math part of finance and investing was involved. So what I saw at AQR was I saw the early folks at AQR, the folks who built it up when it was nothing. And I learned how they operated. From the distance that I could, I even got a chance to work closely with some of them. But there was this aura about them. I idolized them. And I began getting pretty curious about how they built it. How does a founder build anything? And I wasn't going to learn about it by reading blogs or reading books or going to school. It's possible for people to do that. This was back in 2010. These things just didn't exist back then. Venture wasn't this sexy industry it is today. The New York startup scene, I'm based in New York, was tiny, if existent at all. So I basically decided, look, if I want to learn about this thing I'm curious about, I'm going to have to go talk to people who have done it or who are doing it. So I joined a startup as its first employee to learn. Fast forward a little bit. I was there for a couple of years. I realized I wasn't making the hedge fund money anymore. Time still kept on ticking. My then girlfriend and I wanted to move forward in our lives. We wanted to get engaged, wanted to get married, all of which gets real expensive real soon. So in a way, it was what I learned at AQR, what I realized I wasn't going to get at AQR, I was going to get somewhere else. I joined there. It was there that what has now become Equity Zen was really born, because these engagements, the engagement ring, the wedding, all these things that get expensive, guess what? If I had worked at the hedge fund, I would have been able to pay for it a lot more easily. So instead of being able to do that, what I ended up doing was realizing, hey, I have this equity in the startup that I've worked in for the last couple of years. And I've been fortunate because it's worth a little bit more now on paper than it was before. Oh man, wouldn't it be great if I was able to sell a little bit of this, because I'm in a real pinch right now and I'd be really happy and my girlfriend and I would be able to get married. That's ultimately what has happened and what Equity Zen tries to solve for the thousands and thousands of people who are putting in a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, but are getting paid in a currency that's pretty illiquid. Mm-hmm. Long story short, the rest is history. My then girlfriend and I are now married and we have a little one. So it's been a wild journey. I would not have predicted it at all 10 years ago. But yeah, it all started with taking a job that was a little more normal. But I'll mind you, I graduated in 2008, and much like today, the world looked pretty chaotic. No one knew what the next year was going to bring.
So many things to talk about there, but we'll definitely go into your advice for students. But before that, Equity Zen, if I understand, is helping to connect buyers of pre-IPO shares with early employees who have these shares and connecting these two in the marketplace. Who was your first customer? How did they trust you to buy a product and buy shares of a company?
Yeah, it's tough. We as a people have a really interesting relationship with money. I joke about this. I might forgive Facebook for losing all my photos. I might even forgive Google for losing all my photos, and I back up a lot of my photos on there. But if Citibank lost $1 from my bank account, I would never trust them again. I could never look past that. You're right. Earning the trust of the first few clients was a real challenge. Just really quickly to set the stage, what Equity Zen does is we operate similarly to a stock exchange, but for private companies. You have lots of private companies now, many of them worth a lot, many of them employing thousands of employees. You have these employees, you have the early investors, you have the investors that invested 10 years ago that today are still holding private company shares. 20 years ago, that company would have gone public and the shares would have been freely traded. So because of this dynamic of companies staying private longer, people who supported the company and got paid in its equity have to wait longer and longer until they can turn that those shares into cash, just like I had to and wanted to pay for my wedding. So that's what Equity Zen does. We take the small shareholders, match them up with a bunch of buyers who want access to the company, who are big fans, but because the company's not publicly traded, they can't just go to their E-Trade account or Fidelity account and buy or sell. So that's what Equity Zen does. The way it ties into what you were just asking about, the sell side, I think you can appreciate, it was a little bit easier to convince someone of. At the end of the day, I was going to hand them some money, or we as a firm were going to hand them some money. So they were a little bit easier to convince. The buyers, it turns out, it was 2013. The stock market had been rising for 4 or 5 years. What is now a 10-year bull run was still in its first half. And so you have a lot of investors who are like, well, I'm making enough money in the public stock market, but if I'm making this much money in the public stock market, maybe I can make even more money in the private stock market. And I know that sounds greedy or yield seeking. At the end of the day, that's what an investor does. They're supposed to build diversified portfolios. They're supposed to figure out which asset allocation is going to work best for them. Our service was not a fit for a lot of investors. First of all, you have to be accredited. But even among the accredited investor user base, we wanted to make sure that this investment type was appropriate for them. So we're talking about people who said, I'm making a long-term bet. I believe in these companies. This company is going to be public someday. And instead of buying 5 years from now, I'd like to buy now and have even more of the appreciation. So we were able to find through months and months and probably hundreds, if not thousands of people that we spoke with, in order to convince them that, first of all, we don't even want to sell to everyone who's willing to buy. We only want to sell to the people for which this is a fit. And if you are one of those, here's how it works. And I think once we figured out that a lot of no's are common in order to get to the first appropriate yes, it actually became a lot easier from then.
Interesting. And this entire industry is very fascinating because last week we talked to Tim Draper, and Tim Draper was one of the first people who tried to open up this investing in pre-IPO VC stocks and letting the public have access to this market. But it's been incredibly difficult for anybody to invest in anything in this category.
Yeah.
What changed to make Equity Zen be able to be that marketplace?
It still is incredibly hard. So I don't want to say anything has changed on that front. Look, the world's full of really hard problems, and there's plenty of people willing to solve the hard problems. I think we just happened to have this hard problem to solve, and we've stuck with it. I honestly think that's really one of the biggest differentiators. But let's just talk about why it's hard, right? Securities transaction, we just talked about how we have a interesting relationship with money in our society. Securities transactions are super complicated, not only for finance reasons because it touches money, but for legal reasons. Mm-hmm. So mistakes are easy to make when something's complicated. And if you make a mistake in this area, it's super expensive, not only because you lose the money, but because you have all these rules that you may have potentially violated. So most people who want to buy or sell bring in professionals, lawyers, bankers, accountants, in order to basically avoid making those mistakes. Mm-hmm. Because the mistakes are expensive, fine, I'll just pay up front to get it right. But you add all these specialists' cost, and the transaction cost becomes quite large. And in order for that investment to be worth it, or that transaction to be worth it, if the transaction cost itself is large, the actual transaction has to be large for us to swallow paying this much of a fee. So historically, investments and trading in general of private market shares has been limited to folks who can write usually a $10 million or larger check. That way, it's worth it. You can pay all the specialists to not make a mistake and get it right. What Equity Zen has done, and again, it's a hard problem to solve. We've just decided to stick to this, solving the same hard problem. And over time, it becomes a little bit easier because you make a little bit of progress each year. What Equity Zen has done is taken that $10 million minimum and turn it into a $10,000 minimum. So if you think about the number of people who have $10 million to invest, versus the number of people who have $10,000 to invest. It's obviously we're talking about making this asset class accessible to many, like orders of magnitude more people. And again, remember, it's still not appropriate for everyone. So hopefully someday we'll bring access available to people with a $1,000 kind of minimum check size. We're not there yet. But what EquityZen is doing is trying to bring to folks who have a smaller check the same type of access, because for each individual person to hire a lawyer, an accountant, a banker would be too expensive. But we'll take the cost, spread it out over thousands and thousands of transactions, and every individual transaction doesn't have to be quite so large to justify it.
And during that process, which side is more difficult, to get buyers to be interested in taking on this investment or sellers to give up their shares?
Yeah, it's funny. If you ask the buyer, they'll say the seller is difficult to get. And if you ask the sellers, they'll say the buyer is a pain in the butt. And of course, the answer when you're a marketplace is both. They're both very valuable and they're both very attractive and they're both very difficult to please all the time. As with any marketplace, especially where the buyer and the seller are exchanging something that can be measured apples to apples, a dynamic that's different and we'll call it Etsy is, let's say you're a buyer on Etsy and I'm a seller. I'm a craftsman. I make wonderful keychains. The value of a keychain is what I'm asking for and you're willing to pay for it. When we're talking about a share, it's effectively what I'm asking for, what you're willing to pay for it, but there may be someone else who's willing to pay 1 cent higher, 1 cent lower. Mm-hmm. And then maybe someone else is willing to sell for a dollar higher, a dollar lower. But there's only one keychain maker who makes the keychains like the kind that you like. And so when you're talking about something that's a lot more fungible, like the securities, what you end up with is a little bit of a zero-sum dynamic. At some point, what's good for the buyer is less good for the seller, and what's good for the seller is less good for the buyer in the moment. Now, you fast forward a few years and you say, hey, you know what? I'm really glad I sold those shares because I was able to buy an engagement ring and get married, something I would not have been able to do if I hadn't sold at that price. And I might still be very happy even if the stock price continued to appreciate. And it's those win-wins that the buyers and sellers are really looking for. The buyers at the end of the day are saying, I want to buy low, sell high. The sellers are saying, I want liquidity today. I'm overexposed to the stock of this company. I would like to, honestly, if nothing else, sell some of these shares and stick it under my mattress, put it in the S&P, or buy a house or buy an engagement ring or whatever they want to spend money or pay off a loan. So it really is the case that on each side of the marketplace, the other side seems harder. But sitting in the middle, our job is to try and bring a marketplace together where enough transactions clear and effectively liquidity is high.
In this process, is there any like big lesson that you took away or any like mistake that you made that for future students who are thinking of becoming entrepreneurs, they can avoid in the future?
Oh, I've made thousands of mistakes. Working at a startup before taking a crack at EquityZen was probably one of the best decisions I've made. And I'm not saying because that startup, honestly, it could have been any startup that just gave me 2 years of experience. I happened to, you know, learn a lot at the one I was at. The point being though, starting a business is hard enough. Starting a business that eventually is lucrative is even harder. So you start layering on probability after probability and you start to wonder, why haven't other people done it? Oh, okay, it was hard. Okay, so then it's another layer of probability on top of that. The big lesson I've taken away is experience does have value, even in industries where you're creating your own market. So maybe not the specific experience of someone who's been there and done exactly this, but if you can identify what type of experience actually matters for your business, not necessarily just fundraising, let's say, but someone who has sold illiquid securities in the past, which is the case for us, that relevance matters a lot. In terms of mistakes, yeah, there's a lot of don'ts. There are some do's. I think the only way to learn is to work at one of these places and take copious notes and listen to what's going on and ask a lot of questions. If you hopefully end up working at the right spot, certainly at EquityZen, man, we are so encouraging of people asking questions, of people asking why this way, why not that way. And we encourage that a lot and have been pretty fortunate that whether it's an intern or chief of staff, they're both willing to and able to and encouraged to challenge the status quo.
I see. On that note, I'll ask a question. I think a lot of financial people are considering when they see something like EquityZen. Naturally, the people inside a company knows a lot more about the company than the people outside of the company. And if I'm a worker, I might know that the company is going to be expanding and I might have a better sense of what the real valuation of the company is. Yeah. How is EquityZen trying to mitigate or lower that imbalance of information?
Yeah. So look, the first things first, there are usually and almost always more than one buyer, or more than one seller. Mm-hmm. So it's not the case that you basically have one person dictating all the terms and the other person basically just has to take their word for it. That is that dynamic that I just described that is different from EquityZen's is more along the lines of what crowdfunding is. So crowdfunding, if you think about it, is the company issuing shares. They have all the information and they're basically saying, we will sell you 50 shares for $1,000 or whatever the case may be. That's true power imbalance on that front. What EquityZen is doing is not building a solution for the boardroom. I mean, while we have had founders use, it's really rare for the founders and the decision makers to be the primary users. The primary user of our service are the rank and file, the employees, the angel investors, the folks who are no longer making decisions in the board meetings. And the idea is, if you're making decisions in the board meetings, you don't need to use EquityZen because you're likely in the $10 million plus dollar category and you can have a saying, you can go get a bespoke tailor suit made. And that's really different than having a suit that can still be customized a little bit, but not as much as if you go to a specific tailor who's going to build you a suit from the ground up. And I think that's really the distinction, is that we're servicing folks who aren't actually looking for the perfectly tailored suit that only they can wear and no one else can wear. It's like that exclusivity is not something we're trying to offer. What we're offering is, hey, you haven't had a chance to convert this currency that you've been working for and being paid in, and you've earned and invested into money. You can't buy a burger with it. You can't buy a house with it. So let us see if we can get you a little bit of liquidity, and let us see if we can get someone else who wants access to the shares, but the only way they can currently get access is by working at the firm. That shouldn't be the only way that you can bet on a company that you're a fan of. And that's really the imbalance we're trying to correct.
I see. In such a competitive market, a lot of VCs adopt Reid Hoffman's approach in blitzscaling or raising massive funding and trying to dominate the market before competitors can take hold. But EquityZen seems to have more of a subdued approach in doing this. Why did you choose more of a less aggressive funding compared to the other companies?
Yeah. So just to be clear, you're talking about raising capital for our own operations opposed to of the companies that we're trading. Yeah, it's a good question. Look, two things. One, I have a little bit of the East Coast or New York mindset in terms of building businesses as opposed to the what I'm going to call the West Coast or Silicon Valley mindset. Neither is good, neither is bad. They're different. We have been focused on my backgrounds in hedge funds. One of the things we looked at all the time is for a company to remain a company and solvent, you're going to need to, at some point, when you put in a dollar, make more than a dollar out. That's not something that needs to happen in the first 10 years of a company. It doesn't even have to happen in the first 20 years of a company. But it not happening, like putting in a dollar and getting 80 cents out, is not the goal. The goal is you want to put in a dollar, be able to get more than a dollar out, and then reinvest more than you made. That's what Amazon did, and that's what everyone tries to emulate. I think the challenge is a lot of companies will put in a dollar, they'll raise money from VCs, they'll put in a dollar, they'll make 80 cents, they'll raise more money, put in another dollar, make 80 cents back. And then what's funding their business is venture capital, and it's not the business model. Why did we decide to go this route as opposed to the other route? A few reasons. One, the problem we're facing is hard enough where throwing money at it alone is not going to solve it. It's going to require time. It's going to require patience. It's going to require, honestly, like even the best surgeons in the world that's operating on something, you can't get 10 of those and get the surgery done in 10th of the time. That's not the problem here. It takes time. It's meticulous work. It takes a lot of patience to be able to say, how can we understand what the buyer's needs are, the seller's needs are, the regulator's requirements are, and the issuer's needs are. One thing we could have done, we decided not to do, is raise a bunch of money, spend 5 years subsidizing all these people's kind of needs, and then realizing that actually, if we take the subsidy away, there's no market anymore. Mm-hmm. What's the point of that? I guess we decided that we wanted to build a business in a manner that we had access to capital when we needed it, but didn't need capital in order to keep surviving. And especially in years like this one, it has served us really well. It's part of our DNA now, and it has been for many years, to be resilient, to be careful about where we're spending, and to not just have acquisition marketing be the driver of growth, but actually have repeat usage of the platform be the driver of growth, if that makes any sense.
I completely see your point. I think if Reid Hoffman possibly was here, he would say that, Sure. Oh, but the competitors might take more of a market share during this period of time of your slower growth. What would you say to that?
I would say, Reid, we're not a spring chicken. We're an 8-year-old company. Show me which competitor is taking our market share.
And then the next question is, which person throughout your dealings with different large-scale pre-IPO companies have been very influential? And what have you learned from talking to these people and seeing them grow their companies?
The big lesson, I think, has been, the big takeaway is no one's got it figured out. It doesn't matter if you're the Mark Zuckerberg, and it doesn't matter if you're the founder CEO of a company that just raised $100 million at a $500 million valuation. The name of the game is, if you're an executive at a for-profit organization, your job is to grow. Your job is to grow the stock price, which requires you to grow revenues and earnings. And so, look, that's obvious, but it's also cheeky in me saying that I think every executive, no matter how large the company is, how small the company is, has a shared pressure. A little bit of it is internal. A lot of it is internal when you're starting off. As you grow in a company, a lot of that pressure becomes external. But the pressure is the same. It's, what did I do last quarter? What did I do this quarter last year? How do I make this better? I guess to connect the two questions together, one of the things I've learned by speaking with folks that have been at these large, almost unicorn type companies for many years is realizing that they're heavily over-indexed to that company. There's actually a lot of public companies today that issue public company stock, their own stock, to their employees as compensation, much like the way private companies do. And I think a lot of folks, maybe not the folks that make the board level decisions, but a lot of the executives, the vice presidents, the directors, senior directors, one quote that always stuck with me from a VP at one of these companies was, you know, a lot of my colleagues haven't lived through 01 and a lot of my colleagues haven't lived through 08, but I have, and I'm selling a little bit at the moment I can, because I'm getting my salary from this place. I'm getting my health insurance from this place. I'm getting my stocks from this place. I'm getting my retirement benefits from this place. Do I really want to put everything into the same? Do I want to put all my eggs in the same basket? No matter how good that basket is, it's just, it doesn't make sense to a lot of people. And I think that's why a lot of folks end up diversifying. It's not really a lack of confidence or confidence in the business. A lot of sellers end up selling, including folks that have helped build a lot of these companies from the ground up, is saying, oh, at the end of the day, my identity is different than the company. My needs are different than the company. If I have a daughter going to school, the company has very different timing needs than I do in terms of cash. And so I guess the one kind of commonality is, A, no one's got to figure it out. B, it's healthy to have a little bit of a gap in my decision-making versus my employer's decision-making.
That's so interesting and such a great answer. Wow. Okay. Second to last question is, you graduated during one of the worst economic crises in the world, and we're going through a similar crisis currently. What do you see as parallel, and as graduating students or as college students, what can we do to navigate through this process?
Yeah. I would be lying if I said there were no parallels. There are definitely parallels. I do think what we're going through right now is worse. It's weirder. It's scarier on a much more visceral way for many people. There are tons of parallels. The primary one being, there's a lot of information that is speculation that is going around as fact. That happens during every crisis. It happens when things are stable. Of course, it's going to happen during crises. So I think both that pattern and my advice, or something that I try to remind myself of, and I think students would benefit from as well, is to seek out the other perspective. Most things in life, especially the types of things that we're dealing with in crises, are not black and white. They're nuanced. There's a lot of, it's really hard, and it's actually almost incorrect to make binary statements. This is good and this is bad. Elementary school kids know that things are not quite so simple. And I think somewhere along the way, it becomes hard to remember that all the time. I would say that's something I remind myself of or try to, and I encourage others to remind themselves of that as well. Outside of that, I think one other item that comes to mind for me is to be patient. Again, it's something so fundamental, so silly almost to say, but it helps to have a reminder of that. The people that didn't panic and sell at the bottom in 2008, 2009, the people that ended up realizing that, look, humanity's been around for a long time. The darn stock market's been around for 100 years. Yes, there's been a lot of weird stuff that we've seen, but during that time, let's just pick the stock market. During that time, we saw the Great Depression. We saw the tail end of World War I. We saw the Great Depression. We saw World War II. We've seen three other wars during that time. We've seen shocks to commodities markets, oil spiking up and down. My point is, we as a society have seen a lot. And sometimes it's easy to forget that this too shall pass. So I think that's probably my recognition of the same pattern repeating itself, where it feels like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen tomorrow and the next year and the next year. And maybe just a good reminder that we might not know what's going to happen, but it'll happen. And I just have to have a steady mind and a positive outlook.
100%. And I think on the be patient side, for students, this might not be the stock market per se, but it might just be looking for jobs. Maybe job opportunities are less right now, but if you wait a little bit further, be patient, I think the opportunities will reshow itself.
That's a great perspective, yeah.
Yeah. And then the final question is, what do you think is the future of financing these companies? There's pre-IPO shares trading, there's ICOs, there's crowdfunding. What do you see in 10, 15 years, this entire industry or regulation space be?
10, 15 years, that's a Tim Draper question. My eyesight doesn't go that far out. I think the trends are going to continue, but they're going to be a lot slower than we hope. Is blockchain going to go away? No. Are ICOs going to go away? No, but it's going to be way slower than people wanted. In 2017, people were thinking that the Federal Reserve is going to ditch the dollar and switch over to a cryptocurrency in a matter of 10 years. And I think the same people would say, oh, that's a long ways away now. I think my generic answer, but I do think it's true, is the trends will continue, but the pace of change will be way slower than you thought, especially when it comes to finance. The only thing that in the last 6 months that's really accelerated hasn't really been in America or other first, like, top tier economies, but in a lot of emerging and developing economies, is the adoption of paperless or like currencyless transactions. In a lot of developed economies, like, the momentum is already shifting in that direction. But in a lot of developing economies, it used to be cash only. And because of, you don't want to touch something that someone else who potentially has been exposed to something has been touching, that has accelerated really rapidly. I don't think that's going to be true for private investments or public investments or any of that stuff.
Thank you so much, Atish. And check out PenPack if you have a chance. It's in the link below. And it's been such a pleasure, Atish.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for listening. And make sure to check out more content and subscribe to our podcast.